I'm Mark Feinsand, executive reporter with MLB.com. I recently had a chance to sit down with Diamondbacks Executive Vice President and General Manager Mike Hazen in his office at Salt River Fields in Scottsdale, Arizona. We discussed a variety of topics, including how his time in Cleveland and Boston shaped him into the executive he is today, why Major League front offices need to stop hiring so many Ivy Leaguers, and why Paul Goldschmidt remains one of the most anonymous superstars in the game. Enjoy. So, Mike, you played for 4 years at Princeton. You were drafted in the 31st round by the Padres in 1998. Before a shoulder injury ended your career. How tough was that for you to deal with as a guy who obviously had your sights set on a professional playing career?
Yeah, you know, it was when your career comes to an end, it was sort of jarring, I think, probably as it is for most of the players here now and the players that we've dealt with for a while. One thing as a point of clarification, my shoulder injury didn't end my career. My lack of ability ended my career.
I read they were being nice.
Yes. As history has gone on and time has healed some wounds, somehow my playing prowess is perceived to be far better than it was at the time. The fact is I just wasn't very good. And, you know, but again, you don't think that way, I think, when you're a minor league player. You know, everybody, and that's great, and that's what we want all our players to do too, is, you know, you start to play professional baseball, and why can't you play in the big leagues? You know, you're here, you have a uniform, and they pay for you to do it. And you always had those dreams when you were a kid. And unfortunately, that wasn't meant to be. So I had to think pretty quickly, as a 24-year-old non-prospect, you know, what I was going to do next. And you know, I had to make that decision fairly quickly, I think. And you know, it wasn't my choice, but you have to move on and pick up. And, you know, I do think one of the big things for me in that is I always keep that in my mind and have, being a farm director and others, that when you're now on the other side of that table, you know, how extremely difficult it is to hear that. I only had to hear it once. Some players have to hear it a lot. But hearing it once, and as devastating as it was, has always stuck with me. Every time we sent somebody out of camp or we had to release somebody as a farm director, you very quickly can put yourself in that person's shoes. I think it's something that keeps you pretty humble about what you're doing. And there's a personal, you know, there's a personal aspect of each one of those when you do it. You know, and I think I value that perspective, even as hard as some of those conversations are. I value that perspective, you know, because when you end up doing a lot of them, as you do when you have big camps in the minors or the majors, you know, sometimes the challenge is running together, and you never want that to be the case.
How did you land your first job as a non-player?
Yeah, so, you know, when I was done, I didn't know what I was going to do. I don't think working in a baseball front office was really a thing. It's become a thing. At the time, I had never even thought of it or heard of it. And, you know, I knew who a general manager was and all, but I never really thought about what skill set I had to really work in a front office. But just starting to talk to people about what to do next, and really the one simple thing was I love the game of baseball, sort of, period. That's all I knew. And I didn't want to stop playing, but I was going to stop playing. And so the next step really was trying to figure out how to maybe stay in the game somehow. And I, you know, whether it had been coaching or scouting or anything like that. So I just started sending resumes around. Scott Bradley, who was my coach at Princeton, put me in touch with Mark Shapiro and Peter Gammons. And, you know, through that circle, I ended up getting an internship with the Cleveland Indians. And I worked for Peter for a summer in the Cape, scouting the Cape League. He loved the Cape League, but didn't have time with all he was doing to get down there. And so he was like, just go down there and watch games and send me reports, and I'll try to help you out as best I can. And he sent those reports around to GMs, and at the end of the summer started getting phone calls, and, you know, ended up getting an internship with the Indians.
During your time with the Indians, you worked your way up from intern to mm-hmm. advanced scout, assistant director of pro scouting, and ultimately assistant director of player development. Mm-hmm. As you made your way through the ranks there, was becoming a GM your ultimate goal?
Not really. Again, I think I didn't really know what any of that meant when I first got there. One thing that I'm extremely grateful to, even as an intern, was the things. And John Hart was in his last year as GM there, and then Mark took over. Mark hired me, but John was there for that first year. And I still remember even that first year walking in to do John Hart's board, his 40-man roster board in his office, and he'd be on the phone, and you know, you'd knock and not want to come in, and he'd be like, "No, come on in here. Stand. You can learn by listening to people talk on the phone, and you can be in here if you want to." And I had that early exposure to those guys, to Mark and John, and both treated me that way the whole time. And you know, as respectful as you tried to be, there was such an open door and exposure to anything and everything that was going on in the organization that you couldn't help but learn. I think over time, as I watched them do their job, you know, in the end, I didn't necessarily think that I'd be a general manager someday, but sort of being in a leadership position in a baseball front office, whether ultimately as a farm director or otherwise, was something that I think I could, you know, do this in time, hopefully. I like, you know, being around these guys, being part of the team, as we made a lot of decisions and we went through some ups and downs there. It was a great learning experience, though, and it's because of, that's the way they made it. And again, I try to keep that in the back of my mind, too. Now that you're in a different role, you know, you have the ability to set that same, you know, culture or dynamic if you want.
I feel like I've asked this exact question to about 10 other guys so far this spring. What did you learn most from Mark Shapiro? I feel like everybody worked for him at some point.
We may all have. He was so focused on building the culture of the organization through so many different avenues. It was two of the things that probably stand out were maybe from a front office standpoint of the quality of hiring, every hire that mattered. From internship, the whatever, you know, even when we were going through our internship process, like the seriousness through which we took that, when I moved above that and sort of then became part of the hiring process for the internship position, the standard that we held, the what we were looking for, the standard which was you should be looking for future general manager, right? And you know, everybody gets pretty busy with everything that goes on during the course of a season with a baseball front office, the draft and the season itself and all these other things. And, you know, you can lose focus on having that standard for hiring interns and other employees. And he always made sure that that standard was extremely high. And I think that led to the culture that exists within his organization. And then from a player procurement standpoint, you know, he was very, the cultural aspect of it in terms of makeup on the team was always a big deal to him about what types of players we had playing for us and that it mattered. You know, talent mattered, but the makeup mattered too.
It seems like front offices around the league are loaded with Ivy Leaguers. Mm-hmm. Aside from the obvious education you all received, do you think there's a reason that front offices are skewing that way in recent years?
No, I don't. I mean, I think one, as an industry, we need to do a little better job of branching out of that. Diversifying, you know, backgrounds, I think, a little bit more. That's a challenge for all of us that I think we can all get too insulated into how we think and thinking the same way. Is it dangerous from a decision-making process standpoint? You know, I do think, you know, the connections are part of how any industry probably works. But we try to stay away from that in a lot of cases because we don't want to get wrapped up in again, like channeling one type of person that we have here, one that think all the same way, that look at the game the same way. The best part about this game and with the increasing influence of all these outside factors is there are opportunities for so many different types of backgrounds to make an impact on a baseball operation. I think we're seeing that organically through web development, data development, architects, you know, and that's just on the non-baseball side of things. Software development, which will branch out into different backgrounds, I think, skill sets than some of the people that you may be talking about. And then I think, you know, the one of the interesting backgrounds that is the former player that is now interested in front office work, you know, the guy that's actually lived it for real, not like some me for fake, but you know, has played 10 years.
A lot of you played college ball. I've seen that. But
10 years of big league time, right? Of guys that, you know, we've had the fortune of hiring. We you know, guy we had in Boston and Brian Bannister, and the, you know, a couple of guys, Dan Haren and Burke Badenhop here. And you see that Tommy Hotovy in Chicago Cubs and others, you know, you see a lot of those guys that have this desire. Gabe Kapler working in front offices, that they have such a unique background and skill set, you know, that brings so much to the table in terms of, for those of us that never experienced that and can't really see it through their eyes. So I do think with the way each organization seems is trying to create competitive advantages for themselves, in doing that, part of that is going to be expanding the breadth and the diversity of their front office.
Yeah, the Twins brought in Torii Hunter and Latroy Absolutely. Hawkins, Michael Kadire this year.
Right. It's pretty easy to see and why they're doing that. Like, hiring impact people that have a skill set that a lot of people that, like me, just to speak for myself, don't have. And I think there's an increasing value on that, and I see. And I think ownerships are recognizing that, in the sense that we're expanding our front offices. We're making investments in those areas and jobs in front offices, which is awesome. I think it's only going to help the game.
It seems like a lot of those positions used to be, oh, you'll bring in the former player to, you know, be a face and
totally
wave his hat and go to some luncheons, right, and that kind of thing. And now a lot of the players
there's
who
real
are
job descriptions.
Getting in, these are real jobs.
Well, because they want them, I think. I think the being a part of the baseball operation, this is a very challenging environment and industry, and it's they're hard jobs, but I think they're rewarding jobs. You're part of a team that could win, and I think just like we are, I mean, they're more addicted to that from their playing days than even we are, right? The thrill of being part of a team that has a chance to, you know, one of 30 teams that could win a World Series.
And you don't necessarily have to travel the baseball schedule as a coach or a manager.
So I think the balance can be struck a little better from a family life standpoint. But, yeah, I think the traditional path was in the past, you know, maybe that some of these guys would go into coaching, and now there's this, I think it's expanding into other areas, and so I think it's great for the game.
You joined the Red Sox in 2006 mm-hmm. as the director of player development. For a kid raised in Massachusetts, was that a dream to go work for the Red Sox?
It was. When the Red Sox called, I remember Mark calling me in, and we were in a hotel in downtown Cleveland having these leadership meetings, and he said, hey, look, the Red Sox want to interview you for the farm director job, and John Farrell was the farm director at the time, and he just said, and this is another thing that I take away from him, he said, if they offer you the job, you got to go. Like, I'd love to keep you here. You have a job here. If they offer you the job, you got to go. You got to take this opportunity. You got to take this responsibility. You got to take this step. Don't just stay here because this is what's comfortable. I always remember that. And being pushed into that challenge, which I probably wasn't ready for. I'm sure Theo and Ben will attest to that when I got over there. But, yeah, being able to go home was phenomenal. The team I grew up watching my entire life with my dad, and you know, it was great opportunity. And then not even really knowing what I was getting into, ending up being able to work with Theo and Jed and Ben and a lot of others is an experience I'll never forget.
I'm sure nobody came out of the woodworks to ask you for tickets or anything, right?
Your ticket list got a little bit longer, certainly.
Let me guess, mostly for the Yankee games.
No, not there.
Duquette told me that when he was the GM, he also from New England, he said all of a sudden everybody wanted tickets, but they only seemed to want them for the Yankee games and the playoff games. Right. I said, where are you when Cleveland's in town or Detroit's in town?
Somehow my ticket requests were fairly, you know, they went 81 strong for playoffs. So.
Under your watch with the Red Sox, you developed players like Dustin Pedroia, mm-hmm. Jacoby Ellsbury, John Lester. How rewarding was it to see those guys play such key roles on a World Series?
Yeah. There? Well, number one, developing under my watch is a very generous statement. I think, yes, I was there while those guys were there too. Those guys needed very little development. They did the majority of what they were going to do, and because of the talent and the makeup that they had. I will say, being a part of a group the scouting group that we had there that was bringing in those players year after year after year, and then seeing those guys come up through the system, have an impact on the organization, have an impact on the team, and really in 2007 having a large impact on a World Series championship team, and then even in 08 going all the way to the ALCS and 09 making the playoffs, it was very rewarding watching kids that you got to see in A-ball, you know, whether they struggled or not or how they got to where they got, or the Anthony Rizzos and the, you know, and others that came up through there. You know, that's part of what makes the game so fun, to work in it. Those are your rewards in the front office, is to watch those guys fulfill their dreams and be successful on those large stages, and watching them become a part of a team and in the organization when sometimes, you know, it can be a challenge with an older team or a younger team trying to blend all those things together, and watching those guys become part of the fabric and of Red Sox history was phenomenal. But, you know, you can't do those things without having great scouting departments that bring those guys in year after year. And I mean, look at the makeup of the guys that you're talking about between Lester and Jacoby and Petey and Uke and, you know, and then Papp and Daniel Bard and all the guys that came up through there. So
I would assume that after 04, I mean, a lot of that 04 team, some of them were still there in 07, but bringing in new blood was probably important to getting that second championship, because not that there was complacency among the old guys, but once you've done it, it's different going for a number two, whereas guys who weren't there for 04 were probably taking a different approach to it.
Yeah, I think it was more of a natural. I think that 04 team was a little older, and I think it was just natural that the roster was going to roll over. I think we saw, you know, where that team was headed and what we wanted to do from trying to sustain that run. You know, as good as you are at the time, if you're not looking down the road 2 or 3 years, you're going to get yourself caught into a bad spot that is going to be a lot harder to get yourself out of. Now, to get there, sometimes you have to make tough decisions that don't necessarily match up with what your fan base is expecting to see. You know, you ride everything out until the end, to when your team gets too old, it could be too late. You know, and so I think a lot of decisions that were made to make sure that we were infusing a lot of those younger guys onto the rosters was strategic by Theo in terms of trying to sustain that run for as long as possible. And I mean, look, even that's not, you know, fail safe in a lot of ways, because when you bring young players onto your roster, there's going to be some volatility with those young players. And there was, we were very fortunate as those, some of those guys that came onto the roster in Petey and Uke and Papp and Ellsbury and those guys, Johnny Lester, they sort of, in a lot of cases, hit the ground running. But you know, that was sort of something that needed to happen, I think, given the different, where the organization was in 04 to 07.
A lot of the guys you worked with in Boston at that time, Theo, Jed, Ben, yourself, are now with other teams, top decision-making positions. When you think back to that group being together, it was almost unrealistic to think you would all stay together for a long time.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I never thought. The best part about that group, and I can say this, and I'm sure it happens in other places, but from my perspective, was nobody wanted Theo's job. Nobody wanted Jed's job. Nobody wanted Ben's. Like, everybody had a job to do, and everybody just kind of kept doing it. And I think that's part of the culture that Theo created, that everyone being as part of the team felt valued as part of the team. And I think that's why, I don't know, at the time I never, now I sit back and look at it and say, okay, maybe, you know, we should have thought that way. I don't think anybody was bold enough to think that, you know, to think what would happen as those things kind of all split apart over time. But, you know, I look back on those days, we all do, with tremendous fondness. I'll never forget having worked with that group of people. And, you know, maybe the band will get back together someday, and when we're all old and decrepit. But, you know, it was such a blast. And that's all because of Theo, you know, and what he created there. It was so much fun coming to work. It was crazy. It got crazy sometimes. I can't tell you any of those stories, but they, you know, it was a great place to be. And we had some ups and we had some downs, you know, and the ups in Boston are great and the downs in Boston are tough, just like they are in some other places. But, it was a great place to be.
you interviewed for GM jobs in San Diego and Anaheim. I've been told the GM interview process is quite grueling. Mm-hmm. What did you learn most from going through that process a couple times?
How little you know about the game. You know, it was an interesting dynamic. It's an interesting process. You know, you try to prepare. You watch from afar 29 other teams, and part of our job is knowing 29 other teams, but you never really know any organization inside and out. You can't, because you don't really know a lot of the personal things about what goes on in the organization, whether it's how the front office operates, how the ownership structure operates, how what the players are really like, other than evaluating them and the cursory makeup information you have on players. So, you know, think you really go into those things blind in a lot of ways, as much preparation as you try to do. But it was a great experience on the backside, because when you didn't get that job, you came back out of there, you were a little more of an expert on that organization, at least for your organization, because
right. You
know, you had studied their minor league system in detail, or their recent drafts and international signings and their major league team. And so that was, and it's always, you know, it's always interesting, because even in those interview processes, it's not usually a one way street. It can be conversational at times, and you learn a lot about how that organization operates, and that's fascinating to me. Because I think you can take some, everybody does things well, and we all do things probably not as well. And, you know, you try to pick up on those pieces. We all copy each other in some way, shape, or form on certain things. That's how this league runs. So when you could pick up some of those things, it was great.
After 4 years as the assistant GM in Boston, you were promoted to GM. Yet the perception was that because Dave Dombrowski mm-hmm. had final say, your power was limited. Was it difficult? Was it a difficult situation?
No, I think that's accurate. Whether power being limited or basically being in the same role. I mean, yeah, that's what it was. Dave was the number one decision maker. At the end of the day, you know, he made decisions. Where it worked so well was internally. Dave didn't operate that way. You know, he's accountable and was responsible for every decision in the end, and that was his choice to make. But the way he, I mean, valued everything that we had to say, and any one of those, anytime you're involved, the way I look at it is, and this goes for me now here, is whenever you're involved in a decision, if you have a voice in that decision, if you have an opinion given in that decision, you're responsible for that decision. It doesn't matter what it said, what publicly is perceived as who has final say. I've always felt that if you're going to have something to say, you better be accountable to what you say. And if you are wrong, you are wrong. Some of the things that went sideways on us in Boston, they weren't Ben's fault, they were mine. And I still carry that with me today. And, you know, again, he was the ultimate authority in that situation. And so it is, you know, those things happen in the game. But from my personal perspective, I was just as responsible for everything that happened, and to why some things ended up going the way they did. But again, so when Dave came in, I mean, however the structure was, being included in every inch of what we did as an organization, I mean, Dave did that, and so it was great. You know, we got to learn a ton from somebody that had, one, operated a front office a lot differently than the ones that I had been exposed to, and then took a lot from that, and then two, you know, he valued what I had to say in a lot of cases. And so, you know, that was a rewarding experience.
You obviously knew Torre Lovullo yep. well from your time in Cleveland and Boston. Was it an easy decision to bring him out to Arizona?
It was an easy decision to bring Torre. It was a tough decision in choosing the manager because of the candidates we had. Phil Nevin was outstanding. He's going to make a great manager. Really came down at the end between those two guys, and the pool we had was fantastic too. But in the end, I remember going, Allard Baird used to always say, every day I knew him, the most important relationship is between the general manager and the manager. And if that relationship isn't working and that relationship isn't solid, you're going to have problems in the organization. And so as much as, you know, it wasn't so much my history from a personal standpoint with Torre, it was the knowledge of how we work together and the ability for us to dig into very difficult conversations very quickly, knowing what the work that we needed to get done here, that was sort of the ultimate reason why. And beyond being watched him be a very good tactical manager, he's a great relationship builder, he's a tremendous communicator, all those skills that a lot of our guys had, and he has exceptional skills in those areas, that was probably one of the biggest separators for me.
You hired a new analytics director here. Was there a feeling that the organization needed to catch up in that aspect?
I don't know. I don't know what catch, you know, for me, what I felt like we would need for a baseball operation to make good, strong decisions was having all the resources available and trying to pin all the variables down to be able to develop that process that fit for how we wanted to see this baseball operation go. And really one of the areas we wanted to ramp up was that. And, you know, we made some changes, which is never easy early. Mike was somebody that we had known from afar. Anytime you can have somebody from the Pittsburgh Pirates organization join your organization, you're doing something pretty well, given how Neil runs his operation and the people that he hires, you know, one after the next. And to get somebody of Mike's caliber was phenomenal. And we just really felt like we wanted to build out in a lot of different areas, and that was one of them. And we've started to do that. So,
outside of fantasy baseball enthusiasts, it seemed like Paul Goldschmidt, maybe one of the more anonymous stars in the game. Why do you think more people have recognized how good he is?
I don't know. You know, I don't know. I think maybe, you know, his workmanlike professionalism, personality, he's so understated. What a great teammate. You can tell already from the day you walk in, the respect that people have for him internally. You never see him do anything outwardly showy, which he probably could given his talent. But we're very fortunate to have somebody of his caliber on this team. I mean, he's a superstar. There's no other way to really describe it. It doesn't bother me at all. We have him, and he's playing for us, so that's great. That's all that really matters, and I don't know how he sees it, but like I said, we're fortunate. And from a teammate standpoint, from a professionalism standpoint, work ethic, he leads the charge in every way.
Zach Greinke didn't have his typical season last year. Shelby Miller's year was a huge disappointment. How do you feel about the overall state of your rotation?
Feel good. I think anytime you get into transitions, you know, you can expect some variability with performance at times. And, you know, Greinke was coming in as a free agent with a big contract. And, you know, Shelby obviously was coming in with the expectations of a big trade, both of which generated a lot of notoriety right off the shoot. And, you know, look, we're everyone's human. And you know, you can try to be unaffected by everything that you're dealing with, but that may be impossible. I think both guys, you know, one of the things that we've tried to express to them is that there is no expectation to live up to. We're trying to come together as a team. It's going to take all 25 guys for us to get to where we want to be. It's not going to take one or two. We don't need one or two people to carry the team. One or two people can't carry a baseball team for 162. It's going to take 25 and usually 40 to get through. And we just want everybody to be part of that one out of 25 to 40 and contribute what they can contribute. And if we can do all that together, you know, we feel pretty good about it.
Do you view A.J. Pollock as an addition of sorts, given the new that played 12 games last season?
I do. And David Peralta as well. You know, I think he's an under-the-radar loss for us for a large portion of the season last year. So having both A.J. and David back on a full-time basis is a huge benefit. It puts, I think, other guys in better positions defensively. I think it improves our outfield defense significantly, which was a challenge last year, and subsequently should help out those pitchers that we were referring to earlier and how they performed. I mean, you know, if we're not catching the baseball, some of the balls that should be caught, then we're not helping our pitching staff at all, and we need to improve on that.
You mentioned Dan Haran before you brought him in as the club's pitching strategist. What do you hope that he can provide to your pitchers?
Well, the experience of being a pitcher for as long as he has in the big leagues and really the transitions he went through as a pitcher are interesting, from when he had stuff to when he didn't, and still having to find ways to win in the big leagues, and his makeup and having been here and the way people talked about him. I think bringing some of that experience onto our pitchers through whether it's mentally, through experience, through the strategy of game planning, how he did things, the way he did them, you know, trying to build out our entire infrastructure on how we continue to teach pitching and our whole pitching program. So he's going to have a large impact on a lot of things that we do.
What kind of player do you think Yasmani Tomas can be?
I think Yasmani Tomas has huge power. You know, he's you know, we're still continuing to work with him. You know, he's played a couple of different positions, and now he's more established himself in the corner outfield. You know, we see him obviously as an everyday player that's going to impact the middle of our lineup. You know, he had a really good year last year, 60 extra base hits. You know, he brings that. We have a lot of really good hitters in our lineup. He brings a lot of thunder, and I think sitting in the middle of the lineup, he's a dangerous guy.
A lot of talent on your big league roster, but the farm system hasn't been ranked very high by those who do such things. How long does it take to restock a system?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, you can look at certain things that were done this offseason with clubs making some significant trades. You know, one club in particular in the American League Central that pulled back quite a bit of talent, some trades, and I think probably shot their farm system ranking from, you know, wherever they were to one of the top. And so I think it can happen that quickly if you're going that route in terms of how some of the trades you make organically, if you know, through the drafting and developing process from the draft when you're selecting the player, or the international market where you're bringing in young players, you know, it can take some time. It can take some time with the, you know, a lot of your best players are probably going to come at the top of those picks or the top of that market. But if we do a good job in trying to find, there are big leaguers all the way through that draft, and that's going to be our challenge, to make sure we find those guys and try to build our farm system as quickly as possible, no matter what we're doing at the major league level. Those things can be mutually exclusive, and I hope that we can do both of those things. But that is of critical importance to us long-term from a sustainability standpoint.
I skipped this one after we were talking about the Red Sox and Dombrowski situation. Was the idea of having your own team, so to speak, one of the biggest things that attracted you to Arizona?
No, not necessarily. Not in a vacuum. That wasn't really an overarching goal. I think the intrigue of being here and seeing the situation and knowing that it was a, you know, being more so probably in Cleveland than in Boston. When I was in Boston, you know, Theo and Ben and those guys, the infrastructure was sort of very well developed. Jason McLeod was there, and they were already having very strong drafts, and the farm system was in a good place, and the major league team was good. You know, when we were in Cleveland, we went through more of a transition from the 0-1 team that tore back down to build up ultimately to the 0-7 team in Cleveland. I saw this in some ways a little more analogous to that, where there was a building process involved and from the infrastructure level underneath the farm system and other things, and it was very, very intriguing. And knowing the people out here, the ownership, they were going through the process and how committed they were to building those things, that was what was most exciting.
How do you view the overall state of the National League West right now?
I think it's going to be a very competitive division. I think there's a lot of really good teams. You know, the Dodgers and the Giants get the notoriety, and they should. I think the Rockies are an extremely, extremely strong team. I think the Padres have done a great job of building talent underneath, even if they're not maybe where they need to be at the major league level. So it's going to be very competitive, and it's a tough challenge. But, you know, hopefully we can figure out a way to knock them off.
Good luck this season. Thanks a lot, Mike.
All right. Thanks, Mike.